This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lacina. Today, we'll talk to Vitol Rybczynski. He's an architect, professor, and writer whose books often study things we sometimes take for granted, examining ideas like when did we first value comfort in the home, or even the unsung history of the screwdriver. His new book, Now I Sit Me Down, looks at the surprising history of the simple chair and how we got from the folding chairs of Egypt to the Barca lounger and even to that monoblock plastic chair everyone has on their patio. He'll talk to us today about the value of studying everyday things and why appreciating the past matters. He'll also explain how an outsider's perspective can give anyone an advantage. Hi, Vitol, how are you?
Good, thank you.
So let's catch everybody up. Can you give us a little primer on some of the things that your books have explored?
Well, mostly I've written about everyday things, little things like tools or big things like cities, parks, buildings. But to answer your question, I need to sort of go back a little bit because people need to understand the differences between aspects of everyday life. And we tend to mix them up. And the way I look at things, there are influences from fashion which are very short term and they change very quickly. And those are the things that are most noticeable because, you know, from 1 year to the next, or even from a few months, we suddenly see changes in the way people behave or the way we talk. Those are short-term changes. Then there are customs that change, and those take almost a lifetime to change. I'm old enough to remember when people still smoke cigarettes. I'm not old enough to remember smoking jackets, on the other hand. So there are customs when the gentleman used to retire to a smoking room and they had smoking jackets because they didn't want their clothes to smell like cigarettes. They had special jackets for smoking. I'm talking about the Victorians and Edwardians. Later on in the modern period, everybody smoked. And then by the end of my life, hardly anybody smokes. And certainly people don't smoke in public anymore. They smoke less and less. So those customs change in a lifetime. But what interests me are cultural ideas, and cultural ideas take hundreds of years to get fixed and change very slowly. And an example of this is the house that I'm living in right now, as we're talking, is about 100 years old, but it has a living room, it has a dining room, it has a kitchen, bedrooms. All these aspects of the way we live in a house were fixed a long time ago, and they haven't really changed very much. So the house was, when it was built, didn't have air conditioning. It didn't have a lot of the appliances in the kitchen that we have today. But the sort of deep ideas about the way the house was organized make it very livable today because those ideas haven't changed. Our ideas of privacy haven't really changed. You know, our ideas of having a private room to call our own or eating around the table. And those ideas are what interests me because they develop slowly and a long time ago, and they're very persistent. They last a long time compared to fashions and customs, which change relatively quickly. So most of my books deal with those cultural ideas and their sources, and I try to sort of unravel where they came from, why do we have living rooms and dining rooms and where did that come from? And always I think in my books is the underlying theme is what does it mean to today? What does it mean to us today? So it's not just history for its own sake, but how does it cast a light on the way we live today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I think one of the most interesting things about your books and that I take from it, and something that we forget, is that most technologies, most innovations, most habits aren't the result of any sort of one great big thing. It's the contributions, tiny contributions over time. And I think it's really important to sort of understand the slowness of that progression. And then I want to take us back to the book that you have called One Good Turn, about the history of the screwdriver, and in particular Henry Maudsley, because he had a special contribution to precision and standardization. Can you tell us a little bit about his contribution and what he did?
Well, as you said, it had to do with precision, and these early inventors like Maudsley had to be extremely skilled craftsmen, because they were making everything by hand. In order to invent a machine tool, you have to make all these pieces by hand, because there are no machine tools. That's what you're trying to invent. And so what's admirable about these early, I wouldn't call them engineers, they're really both craftsmen and engineers, is that they're able to imagine machines, but actually build these machines from scratch. And those machines become really the basis for the whole industrial revolution, because with machines, you can then build all sorts of large machines like steam engines or generating plants or all the equipment that comes with the industrial age. And it really all comes back to these early inventors who create the sort of basic tools, among them the screw, because to make screws have a very old history. They go all the way back to the Middle Ages. But the modern screw is mass produced. And so you have to be able to have a machine that will actually make screws that are very accurate and precise and identical. And it's those kind of machine tools that are really the basis for the Industrial Revolution, because once you mass produce it, it becomes a very cheap little thing. We hardly even think of the cost of a screw or a nail because they're so inexpensive. But they're inexpensive because they're mass produced on automated machines. And it's these automated machines that are the great inventions of that period.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I know, and I think it's so interesting, because what people may just forget about, we take for granted our manufacturing capabilities and things, but here was this man in the 1800s who figured out that you shouldn't have nuts and bolts that are customized only to each other, because that makes fixing things impossible, that creates a lot of confusion, and it's these little steps. Here's this little step that not only sort of fueled the Industrial Revolution, but made possible things like the auto industry decades and decades later, because it's, you know, it laid the groundwork. I think it's this really, really interesting contribution. There's another thing that I thought was super interesting from one of your books, the socket head screwdriver, which is something folks in Canada have that people in America don't often see. And you are a super fan of the socket head screwdriver. Can you tell us what exactly that is, and why, in many ways, it's a superior screwdriver, even though we don't really have any familiarity with it?
Well, it was invented by a man called Robertson, who was a Canadian, and the Canadians refer to them as Robertson screwdrivers. And it's a square head. Instead of a star shape like a Phillips head or a slot, which is the very traditional screw, it's a square head. The advantage is that you can't strip a Robertson screw the way you can with a Phillips screwdriver. You know, if the screw is too tight, you eventually strip it, and then it becomes a real problem. The advantage of the square head is that that's impossible. It also holds the screw perfectly on the screwdriver, which is an advantage. The reason for these different shaped screws is that the slotted screw was not very good for automation, and there was many attempts in the late 1800s or early 1900s to come up with a better head, and the Robertson and Phillips were all inventors trying to solve this problem. And one of the men who had the problem in an immediate way was Henry Ford, because he was trying to mass produce automobiles, and he needed better screws than slotted head screws, because you know, when you're screwing a slotted head screw by hand, it's very easy to strip it. And you could imagine if you're trying to automate that process with an automatic electric drill, it's extremely easy just to screw the whole thing up. So Ford was looking for some new type of screw, and he actually met Robertson as well as Phillips, and he liked the Robertson screw, but Ford was really kind of a control freak, and he said, on buying the patent, he said, you know, I'll use your screws, but you'll have to sell me the patent. And Robertson was a very stubborn kind of person, and it would have made sense for him to sell the patent. Ford would have given him money, lots of money. It wasn't a question of how much. It was just that Robertson was a kind of Scots Canadian and very stubborn, and he just didn't want to do that. And Ford finally gave up and made a deal with Phillips and used Phillips screws. And of course, the rest is history, because that's become the standard screw in most products today. And in Canada, we still use Robertson screws, but they're not as in wide use. Obviously, you need a different kind of screwdriver. And he sort of missed the chance. And it also... It underlines the lesson that sometimes it's not the best technology that wins, and the technology that eventually becomes widespread carries the day. It doesn't have to be the best thing. By the time everybody's using it, just the fact that everybody uses it gives it a kind of power. It's sort of like the QWERTY keyboard that we still use on computers. There are many arguments as to why it's not the ideal keyboard, but because it was adopted early and widely adopted, and then stenographers learned how to use it to take shorthand and type quickly, it just became the standard. So when computers came along, there have been some attempts to improve that keyboard, but basically computers and iPhones all use the same QWERTY keyboard that dates back, I think, to the end of the 19th century. And it's simply, it's there, and it's become the standard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting. And of course, stubbornness and an entrepreneur, I've never heard of that standing in the way of innovation. Let's talk about a little bit about the history of the chair. We'll get back to your current book that you have out. And there's a really, really interesting discovery that you made that was a surprise even to you about the ultimate chair. Can you tell us why the common plastic patio chair is the ultimate chair, and why it's also a kind of a surprising example of globalism?
I thought I would ask some chair designers and chair makers what they thought the sort of chair of our period would be, and several of them answered that they thought the plastic chair was the sort of the most symbolic chair of our time. And that surprised me, because I hadn't really thought about the plastic chair that way. But they made, I think, the point that it's a chair that has become the global chair. You can go to any country in the world and you will find plastic chairs. The reason for that is that they are made all over the world. The plastic industry is global. So people make plastic, you know, buckets and wash basins and all sorts of devices out of plastic. And so the plastics industry is always looking for new things to make, and the plastic chair is just added on to that. Plastic chairs are mass-produced. It takes about 60 seconds to produce a plastic chair, and it's a one piece of plastic. It's very inexpensive. It doesn't rot or break. You can leave it out in the weather. It's light. It's transportable. And for that reason, it's really become the ubiquitous. Nobody's been able to count how many chairs there are, but there must be billions of them in the world, and it's by far the most common chair if you think of the world as a whole. And of course, it's global because it's wherever you go, they're more or less the same. If you go to Thailand, you might find some patterns in the backs of the chairs that are local. But essentially, it's the sort of technology that has very strict requirements in terms of mass production. And whether you go to India or China or the Middle East or North or South America, the chairs are pretty much identical. Which is, of course, the characteristic of global products. You know, sneakers and T-shirts and jeans are the same wherever you go. And so are plastic chairs. So even though it's not an ideal chair, it's not a particularly pleasant chair to sit in. I'd much rather sit in a wing chair or a Windsor chair than a plastic chair. It just doesn't feel very nice. Nevertheless, I think it represents our time. And, of course, as one of slightly cynical person pointed out, it's also a chair that creates enormous environmental problems because it doesn't degrade. It's even when it's broken, you just see them lying on the beach or, you know, lying in a back alley because you can't reuse it for anything. You can't, you know, burn it. You can't modify it. It's very hard to repair a broken plastic chair. The types of chairs. And this is one of the things that really interested in me when I was writing about it is that chairs have limited lives, but chair types last for centuries. You know, rocking chairs date from the late 1800s. Early 1800s. Windsor chairs are even older than that. And yet you can buy new rocking chairs and new Windsor chairs. It's a device that is hard to improve upon. And so people don't bother trying to improve upon it. They basically reproduce it.
You had said to me that one of the things that helps you is that you have an outsider's perspective. Can you tell me a little bit about that, a little bit about your background that sort of helps with that and sort of helps inform you?
Well, my parents were Polish, but they, because of the war, they found themselves at the beginning of the war in England. My father was in the service, the Polish army, which was in England at that point. It had been in France and then gotten out roughly at the time of Dunkirk and all of that whole part of history. And so I was born in Scotland. I was raised in England. My parents then emigrated to Canada, and I really grew up and went to school and lived a large part of my life in Canada and then emigrated to the United States. So in some ways, I was always an outsider. I had a Polish background. I spoke Polish at home. We ate Polish food. And yet the world around me was quite different. And I think as an outsider, you sort of have to figure out what's going on. The world at home and the world outside are two different worlds, the language, the customs, everything. Later on, I got interested in third world housing, and so I traveled a lot and worked in India and China, various countries, where also I was an outsider. But I think being an outsider was part of the way I lived, the way I was raised, and so learning to look at things that an insider might take for granted, I think gave me a sort of different perspective. I didn't take things for granted because I was looking at them in a sense from the outside. And I think that did color the way I approached various subjects. It gave me this vantage point in a way of looking at ordinary things that most people perhaps take for granted and asking, you know, why do we do this this way? Why don't we do it another way? Or where did this come from? Why did people make rocking chairs? Or specifically, for instance, why did Americans make rocking chairs? Because it's an American invention. The Windsor chair which became very popular in colonial America, was certainly a British invention. But the rocking chair was something we invented. And for a long time, most people thought we were sort of crazy. Putting a chair that moves. Chairs were supposed to be stable. You know, chairs are symbols often of stability. The throne, of course, is the most powerful chair symbol, but important people are called chairmen, and they chair meetings. And the chair is something solid and imposing. So the idea of a chair that moves, that sort of rocks back and forth, really undermines what chairs are supposed to be. And Europeans thought Americans were slightly nutty.
Yeah, I think what's interesting, too, about the study of history is that almost by design, you can't help but be an outsider because you don't know necessarily what it was like to live in the past, even if it was even 10 years earlier, because you don't, your memory, even if you live through that time, you're going to be studying things that you weren't exposed to. So studying history is a really, really interesting way to sort of force yourself to kind of test that sort of outsider mentality. But what else can people do? You know, everyone is an outsider in some way. In your mind, like, how can they tap into that or seek that out so that they can maybe also find new insights and perspectives?
I mean, the thing about looking at history and trying to understand, you know, something from the past is you always have to remind yourself that people living in the past don't know what's going to happen. You know, we know what's going to happen looking backwards. We know that, you know, the rocking chair is going to be last for hundreds of years and, you know, presidents will sit in them and it'll become one thing. But at the time, people don't know that and people don't know the outcome of history. And that's, I think, very important in trying to understand the past, because the mistake I think people make is they often apply modern values to the past, and they, as if you had a modern person but going back hundreds of years. But the people from the past were different than us. They actually, I believe, they thought differently about things. If your lifespan is, you know, 30 or 40 years, and people died much younger than we do, you think about things differently. If half your children are likely to die before they achieve, you know, 1 or 2 years old, which is why people had large families, but that, you know, that gives you a different viewpoint towards children and towards the family, and you have to be much tougher minded, I think. You can't be as sentimental as we are about. We have very small families, so we get very sentimental about children. People in the past were not. And when we look at, you know, children working, we get very shocked and we think how awful they made their children work. But they had a different attitude to childhood. There's a wonderful historian who wrote a book about the invention of childhood, because for hundreds of years, there was no childhood. You were an infant, you know, when you were, and then you became a small person and you were expected to work and contribute to the family. And there was no schooling. You were simply sent away to be an apprentice something and learn a trade, you know, probably when you were 9 or 10 years old. So this whole idea of childhood, let alone adolescence, really doesn't exist. And we've, of course, invented a whole series of ages like teenagers and adolescents, and which is a cultural invention. It's not sort of a natural, and it's certainly not age old. I mean, in the past, this was not something that, so trying to put ourselves in the shoes of people living in the past is, I think, very important in terms of understanding why they do what they do and the way they look at things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, that that sort of perspective of nothing's a given, there's nothing that's a guarantee, no guaranteed success, and that everything that you think is obvious probably isn't. Vitor, that's all the time we have. I can't thank you enough for all of your insights. For those listening, to listen to more podcasts from the series, find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and follow us on SoundCloud. Thank you.